Everybody, you are listening to You, Me, Them, Everybody. My name is Brandon Weatherby, and I'm with my very good friend, Sabina Kolvitz. And
hey, everybody.
I've known her, we were just talking about this, for either 5, 6, or 7 years at this point. And I don't know if this is good or bad. We've seen each other 5, 6, or 7 times in that time frame.
Yeah.
But you brought this up, so I don't feel awkward saying this. I consider you a good friend, and you do the same.
Of course. We've had some really fun times together.
We have, but I think that's kind of odd.
Why?
Because, personally, I think one of the reasons why we consider each other friends, besides the seeing each other annually, is the internet, in a weird way. It's because, like, I could keep tabs on you and vice versa. Like, I knew that you were still in Chicago due to Facebook.
Okay, yeah.
Stuff like that. And like, okay, and you came to my birthday thingy.
Because you invited me via Facebook.
Yeah, and it's weird because I talk so much crap about that. And I just really need to stop.
I don't know, Facebook I think is an interesting outlet for that kind of stuff. But I think not like you versus like, that we're friends over the internet, because mm-hmm. we don't really keep in contact that much.
No.
It's not like we're messaging each other all the time
that
over
is true.
Facebook. I think we, you know, we go 5, 6 months without ever saying anything. And then mm-hmm. out of the blue, you know, it'll be like that one time you went to the Sox Park together.
That's right. Because I worked for the White Sox and I saw, and I like that, actually, yeah, that's how I knew you were moving to Andersonville.
Because I saw you on the Red Line that one time.
With
remember?
Suitcases. I do, completely. So it's like a wonderful, weird coincidence, I should say.
I think so.
In a weird, odd way. Anyways, we met at a zine fair fest thingy,
which was my friend's idea that we go.
It was 4 blocks away, if you didn't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're very close to it. For those that don't know, we're in Westtown. Westtown is a wonderful neighborhood in Chicago. It's off the Blue Line, 3 stops from the Loop. If you're interested in the town at all, I can't describe it well enough. Read anything by Nelson Algren, specifically the short stories. About half of them in the Neon Wilderness are set in this building or on this corner.
Interesting.
So if you want to read about drunks and failures from 50 years ago, read it and it's here.
Who is that again?
Nelson Algren.
Do
you not know Nelson Algren?
No,
I
don't.
Oh, I love that man.
I'm going to have to give you some
all right.
books or something.
He is a
short story.
I will talk too long about this man, but he was a writer. His most famous work was Man with a Golden Arm. It was turned into an Otto Preminger film, which was not like the book so much. It starred Frank Sinatra.
Okay.
That gave Frank Sinatra acting cred. Algren got underpaid. He essentially was the loser. He was the character that never won. He put out great work. He was a big, big fan of Hemingway. Hemingway enjoyed his work. He was the Next Generation. Friends with Studs Terkel. If it wasn't for Studs Terkel, Algren's books wouldn't be in print. Because in 88, he got the rights to keep printing them all. Mm-hmm. You know the fountain on Ashland and Division?
Yes.
That's Nelson Algren Square.
Oh.
But okay. In the fountain, there was supposed to be a bunch of like plaques or statue for the man, but because he didn't portray the Polish experience in the brightest light, it's now just a really small plaque and a bunch of homeless people feed birds around it.
I.e. the Pigeon Man.
I'm not the Pigeon Man. The Pigeon Man died, actually.
I know.
The Pigeon Man in Lincoln Square?
Yeah, The Reader did a huge article on him.
The Reader's... This is not about me. I am sorry. You are a very smart woman. You went to IIT on the South Side in Bridgeport for architecture.
Yes.
And you are currently... Are you currently an architect, technically?
Technically, I am not. I am considered actually an architectural intern because you can't really say you're an architect until you take a series of exams, kind of like the bar exam, but for architects.
When are you going to take those?
You have to do 3 years of actual working in an office, essentially 3 years. You have to fulfill a series of credits, what they consider credit hours, and there's 800 credits, and each credit stands for like 8 hours of work in various
areas. So
each,
that's absurd.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, it's, you have to have experience. You can't just, you know, you can't have a stamp and be responsible for a building like 2 weeks after you graduate. Like, that's insane.
Yeah, that's insane. But still, I mean, it's like a doctor. You're doing your 3 years residence right now.
I guess kind of. But, you know, it's always your choice also whether you actually want to take the exam or not. I know a lot of people that have opted not to take the exam because it's just, you know, it's... Unless you want to open your own firm.
Well, do you want to open your own firm?
No.
So what do you want? Why did you want to become an architect? Let's start from the beginning. What made you drawn to architecture? Why did you go to IIT? I mean, you're not from here. We'll get to that later. But like, that wasn't like the neighborhood school.
No. Okay, I don't want to get... When I was in fifth grade, we were supposed to write an essay about what we wanted to be. And I asked my mother what I should be. And she said a lawyer. So from about the fifth grade to right about junior year, beginning of junior year of high school, I thought I was going to be a lawyer.
That's a very good goal.
of my mother's, yes.
She has a great goals.
And then it came time to apply for schools. And I kind of realized that maybe being a lawyer wasn't such a good idea. I mean, in the 90s, you know, they had Rain Man and all these awesome, like, movies where you're, you know, where you're having these life-changing cases. And I was like, dude, I want to totally do that. That's going to be awesome. And then I started seeing a lot of the law firms, like, on the corner of the street, tax law attorney. And I was like, I really, dude, like, that's not what I'm going to do.
Okay.
So what I really wanted to do was actually pursue an English degree, or a pottery degree, which of course...
Do they have a pottery degree?
At IIT?
No, in general.
I think you can do like ceramics or sculpture.
Okay, that makes sense.
I never actually looked too much into it because once I told my mom about my lofty aspirations, she like shut down and was like, oh, hell no. Like, we are not going to pay for you to go to school to get it. My mom comes from East Germany, so
okay.
Anything that is not... an engineering-based degree or something that you could eventually make money in is not really worth her time, I guess. So she said, English and ceramics are out. What are you going to do? And what do you like to do? And so I told her, well, you know, I really like looking at buildings. And she thought, you know, architecture.
Why not be a photographer?
Oh, Lord, no. I don't.
It's too artsy? Or that's not mom approved?
I'm not really that interested in photography. But... I'm not making myself sound very good here. But so that's kind of how it came to be, and at my time at IIT.
Well, no, you never said really why that. I mean, you said that you and your mom talked, and you like looking at buildings.
Why?
How does that lead to I'm going to leave the state to become an architect?
Well, when after my junior year of high school, my parents and I were really at odds. And which eventually evolved into me going to live with my grandparents for the summer. My grandparents live in Germany, and bless their hearts, I mean, they were wonderful. And so they carted me all around, and I mean, it was basically I was exiled, and they were gonna try to do their best to, you know, have me have an entertaining good summer. And once they learned that I wanted to be an architect, they took me to Dessau, to the Bauhaus, which is a school that was headed by Mies van der Rohe, but that was really, like, really progressive in the 20s and 30s in terms of design, not just architecture, but they had all kinds of wonderful thing, like Joseph Albers was part there, who's like a really amazing color theorist. They had a textile program, they had a ceramics program, they had kind of an industrial design program, and you know, the list goes on and on. And so I was fascinated when I
Mies van der Rohe is known more for his Chicago architecture. If from a layman's point of view, am I right or wrong here? Because from Chicago, I know him as the guy that designed IIT,
right,
and a lot of the buildings in the Louvre.
Building. Yeah, and
yeah.
Yeah, but that's because you live in the U.S.
That is true. That is true. But is that the reason why you want to go to IIT?
Yeah, because it's kind of funny how I learned about IIT, because I was on the internet one day, and I think the way that it happened, there was like a pop-up ad or something. I was looking through, I was online for something, and there was a pop-up ad, and it was IIT, and I just decided to click
Are
on
you
it.
Serious?
For some, yeah. Like, this is a very strange series of events, yeah. And like, I decided
I'm
to
learning.
Click on
this
it.
Is wonderful.
And you know, there is of course like this history and this biography of the school. And I was like, what is the Illinois Institute of Technology? And you know, in red is like all of the bolded important parts, and one of them was the Bauhaus of the Midwest. And I was like, oh my gosh, you know, so I have to check this out. And, not, you know, an added perk was that it was in Chicago, as far away from my parents as, you know, possible.
When were you clicking on this link? Were you still in Germany?
No, I was in the U.S. back at this point.
Like, back where? We didn't. I don't think we said where you're from.
No.
So, for those of you with a globe in front of you, you take your finger and you go down the U.S. and then the other side of the globe, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
To Germany and then back to Florida?
Yeah.
So you stayed at your grandparents going into senior year or after senior year?
It was after my junior year of high school.
Okay, and then you applied like a normal, quote unquote, normal person, and
yeah.
And then you went straight to Chicago.
Yeah.
Okay, so you clicked on a link.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually worked.
It worked.
And
that's how I'm here.
Why Chicago? I know you said it's far from Florida, but. A lot. Come on, to me, Texas is far from Florida. Like, why Chicago?
So, I guess I'm from Germany, and when we moved to the U.S. in 1993, it was because my stepdad, my mom had divorced my father, and had married an American who was stationed in Germany. And once he was, you know, once his time was up, we moved back to the U.S. and we lived in Georgia for a long time. And after his stay in the military, we moved to Florida, where he found work. And so I had spent my entire time in the U.S. on the East Coast, on the Southern East Coast.
Okay.
Chicago was really interesting to me because it felt a lot to me at the time like Germany. Like, we had a similar
geography. Where in Germany, by the way?
A similar climate. I was born in Aschersleben, which is in former East Germany, and I lived most of my childhood in a state called Sachsen-Anhalt, which is, like, I think in English it's called Saxony,
okay.
Like Upper Saxony or something like that. So,
is this a city or a suburb or?
Well, Germany is broken up into different states, similar to the U.S., but they're not as. They're, well, I guess they are kind of.
They don't have as much power as the states here in terms of government.
I mean, it's similar.
Okay.
But, so, you know, like, for example, Bavaria would be a region, I guess you could say, or Saxony would be a region.
Okay.
So,
does this bother you that I'm asking you about this?
No, of course not.
I'm sure I'm coming off as, like, an ignorant American, and
no,
I apologize.
It's completely fine. No, it's completely, completely fine. So, you know, after the wall came down, we moved to West Germany, and we lived in a town called Fulda, which is out, well, it's in West Germany.
Okay.
I'm not really, I think it's like an hour outside of Frankfurt.
Okay, and you thought Chicago German was similar to, no, it's not, it's great.
It's fantastic.
You said Chicago was similar to the town you grew up in.
Well, Chicago was similar to what I thought at the time was, you know, like, the climate was very similar. I mean, I'd been living in the southern U.S. where it's hot and humid all the time. So just to get out of that, like the trees were, you know, you had, like, evergreens, which was great. I was looking for, you know, when I came to visit the school, I fell in love with the city. Like,
okay.
I was like, this is my town. Like, I didn't even bother applying anywhere else. Like, I applied to UF because my guidance counselor, like, begged me. And I just knew, like,
Did you get into UF?
Yeah.
Nice.
Well, I got a letter at first that said we need more information, and 3 months later they were like, welcome to Gatortown. Yeah.
That's hilarious. What about IIT?
I got in.
Hell yeah. Like, right away?
Yeah, I went and visited, and they were like, well, let's look at your files, and they said most likely you're going to get in.
That's nice.
There's like a 99% chance.
Well, it's a good school. Like, let's not talk it down here.
Well, it's a good school, but they're, you know, when I applied there, they kind of, yeah, it's a good school.
Okay, I don't want to. Okay, so we kind of got to why you wanted to be an architect. So once you started taking classes in it, did you still want to be an architect?
God, it was a lot different. Yeah, I mean, the first 3 years of architecture school were probably on a clustered basis. Like, when you think about the last 5 years of your life,
mm-hmm.
they were probably the most miserable years of my life ever, but on an individual day-to-day basis, they were like, it was just an emotional roller coaster, and they were the most fantastic days. Like, I would leave studio and I would feel absolutely elated, but, you know, there would be times on an individual basis they were fantastic and I loved every moment of it, but on like a macro scale,
uh-huh.
it was horrible.
Well, I knew you at this point, and you were at the lab. Is it the lab? What do you consider the lab?
The lab is like the computer lab.
Okay, I'm thinking of like, where were you in the when you were like building models and stuff like that?
The wood shop.
Not the room where you had where you did presentations.
Oh Lord, have mercy! Yeah, that you place. Came to my first.
I did.
My first big final review in third year.
You did. Were there, like, from what I remember, like nonstop. You would be there. You had a longer schedule than any other undergrad that I knew. You were there literally till like 3 a.m. and then you'd be back at like 9 a.m.
Yeah, well, you know, they kind of breed that into you. I mean, it's just a thing that
it sounds like first year law school to me. I'm serious. Like,
but it's a lot more fun.
I'm sure it is. Hopefully.
Yeah, I mean, architecture school is a funny thing, you know.
Well, did it get easier over the years? Did it get progressively harder? Was it about the same?
No, it got a lot easier. I mean, the first year or two was all about just basic... There was a guy one time at school who talked about this, and I think it was kind of a fantastic, although very painful way of describing what I think he said most art schools, which architecture, mm-hmm. most schools where you are required to put a part of yourself into something, produce something, and then get critiqued on it. And I mean, architecture is not the only program that's a part of, but where you so intensely put so much of your time into it and so much of yourself into it that there's a progress, there's an evolution that happens where it's, you know, your spirit gets broken and broken and broken again, and you come back up, and that's part of the learning process, is that, you know, you learn to take critique and you get torn down, and then from the very bottom you gather yourself basically and you come back stronger. I mean, it's a very cheesy way of putting
it. No, it's wonderful. It sounds kind of true. It sounds really similar to any art school kid, and at the same way, any English major, for Christ's sake. I mean, you're going through a critique, and if you can take the negative, you're going to make something
better. It's incredibly personal, you know? I mean, you're an English major. You know.
Sadly, I am. Well, the difference is I'm one of those, like, not nice guys where I never cared what they thought.
Yeah.
But it's different when people's like could literally have a building collapse on them.
Yeah, I mean, but, you know, you haven't.
You know, if I make
Hadid famously said, you can have engineers for that. You know?
Yeah, that's true.
But I mean, architecture school got to kind of answer your question.
Yeah, architecture school
got easier.
Yeah,
because once you kind of learn how to think about a problem, and once you learn to, it took me a long time, but once you learn how to view professors not as people that are constantly trying to critique you, but as your peers that you can learn from, it got a lot easier. Mm-hmm. Once you actually get confident in the work that you do, it gets easier and you start to have a lot of fun.
Okay.
Like the last 2 years were incredibly, incredibly fun for me, and I got my ass handed to me a lot of times, but, you know, you learn to appreciate the critique. And one of my professors said it wonderfully. Like, he said it beautifully. He was German, and
did that help, by the way?
No, I tried. My first day I tried talking to him in German, and he was like, no, we're gonna speak English. But you know, he said, we're not trying to critique you because we hate you. We critique you because we love you. Like, we want you to do good. And you
believe those lies.
I don't think it's lies, because once you get into, you know, once you start working at an office, let's say,
okay.
and you have clients, and you have other people that you have to work with that are not architects, but that are, you know, sound engineers, that are structural engineers, that are consultants for everything that you can possibly imagine, which I'm now starting to see. People are going to criticize you and blame you for shit left and right. Like, if anything goes wrong, it's always, like, the first person to point the blame at is...
It kind of sounds like the director of a film, in a way.
It's very similar, you know?
Like, you're not going to do the sound, you're not going to do the editing, you're not going to do special effects, but if they're bad, it's your fault.
Exactly. Another professor that I really had the intense pleasure of working with, Charles Waldheim, had... explained it to us like this, because at the time I was taking a landscape studio, and a lot of people were really freaked out because they were like, we've never been trained to do this. We're not landscape architects. Like, we don't know how to do any of this. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, your job as an architect or, you know, is to be almost like a switchboard operator. It is not to know the minutia of every little thing, because you have people to do that. You are the director.
Okay.
And you connect people, and you are the one that is on the macro scale, you know.
Yeah.
Kind of orchestrating everything. You're the conductor, essentially. Yeah. And you know, once you look at it like that, it's very easy to compare, you know, what architects do to a lot of other things. It's all very...
Well, now that you've had that experience, do you want to do that? Do you want to be that conductor?
It's an interesting question.
How far are you in the 3 years you have to be? You're at least one, right? You're at the end of one-ish?
Yeah, I mean, I also work at a structural engineering firm for a while. I mean, if I wanted to, I probably would have about 1 1/3.
Okay, so you're like halfway. So this is like the time for you to decide. Do you want to be that conductor?
I don't really want to take the exams, no. Do I want to be the conductor? I don't know. You know, it's difficult to say. I mean, I love what I do right now. But you kind of have to, in a theoretical sense, of course I do. You know, everybody wants to have a vision and to fulfill it. But, you know, we'll see.
Well, let's get back to the fun part about it. You said that the last years were actually fun. And before we started recording, you were talking to me about vertical form at the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago.
Uh-huh.
And I have no idea what that is. So what is that?
So what is...
And why was it fun?
A vertical farm, and why was it fun? Well, my last semester at school, when I worked with Charles Waldheim, the other professor was a guy called Eric Ellingson, who is incredible, who I learned so much from, and who's still one of my favorite people of all time. And he before he moved to IIT, he lived in New York, and there is a professor at Columbia called...
New York?
Yes.
Okay.
Dixon Despommier, who was actually... I don't want to get this wrong. I think he was a virologist or...
What, okay, a virologist?
He basically studied, like, outbreaks.
Okay.
I really don't want to get this right, so...
Don't worry about it. He studied something.
He started studying, you know, I think viruses and outbreaks of certain things, and which kind of, you know, after intense studies, kind of led him to, and it had to do with like farming
okay.
food, which kind of, you know, obviously there's problems with horizontal farming. Basically, what the point of a vertical farm is, and like by the year 2050, the world population is going to be like 11 billion. And right now we're at a capacity in terms of arable land where, you know, we were at capacity. Like, there is no way to sustain this growing, like, exponentially population with the amount of arable land that we have. We would need another chunk of land, like, the size of Brazil, which is not,
it's
you
not
know,
gonna
is
happen.
Not available,
yeah.
essentially. And so, not to mention horizontal farming is terrible in terms of, you know, in order to get more farmland, where we're logging, we're tearing down forests.
Yeah.
The amount of pesticides that are going into rivers and into the earth every year is, like, insane. And so the idea that Dixon Despommier came up with, not to mention, you know, your food that you buy, if you live in a city, travels, like, 1,500 miles to get to you. So, you know, we're talking, and then in, stored in those trucks, like a tenth of it goes bad. We're talking, you know, super pollution just via transportation, oil consumption. I mean, all of it. There's a whole chain effect. And so what Dixon came up with was this idea of essentially like a vertical farm, a tall building in a city that's about 30 stories, where these farm products, this produce is being grown.
Okay.
To where, you know, Jeannie Gang was really interested also in these areas of Chicago. Even they're called food deserts, where food deserts are generally located in low income parts of town, where
so the south and west side,
Basically, where...
When it's only a convenience store and there's no fresh vegetables,
exactly,
that kind of stuff.
Exactly,
yeah,
exactly.
Bill Moyer said a big thing about L.A. and Oakland, actually, about this. Yeah.
Exactly. So we have established what a food desert is, basically.
Oh, yeah, it's awful. There's no fruit or vegetables, and if there are, there's usually, like, potatoes.
Exactly.
And maybe onions,
people
and they're overpriced.
People just don't have any access to fresh fruits and vegetables, so that... Like, they go to McDonald's. They go to fast food places.
Yeah, exactly. They go to wherever the food is cheap.
Exactly.
And available.
Exactly. And not to, you know, produce is incredibly expensive.
Yeah.
I mean, to eat fresh, we're not even talking organic. We're just talking about eating normal fruits and vegetables. And so the idea is to get this high-rise building into a city center. And, you know, there are a lot of, like, bells and whistles one could put onto it. You know, reusing the water that gets put into this and going essentially off of the water grid, putting photovoltaic panels onto the building and, you know, harvesting solar energy and actually then putting into the grid and having this farm, quote unquote farm, be essentially, you know, self-sustainable. And the Museum of Science and Industry last year was putting together an exhibit called Fast Forward, and it's still there. And they have a ton of amazing, amazing exhibits. And I would really recommend that anybody go there. It's well worth the time and the money. But was putting on this exhibit and had invited Dixon to make a model or to portray this vertical farm.
Okay.
Make some sort of a media item. And so Dixon, being in New York... Got a hold of Eric, who was my professor at the time. And so with a team of other students at IIT, we put together this model. And it's, you know, it's a beautiful model. And I think it's really educational. So it's good stuff. And it's going to be there until September. But, I mean, some of the other exhibits at that exhibit are insane. There is I was telling you about it
earlier.
You're
talking
today
about this. Continue.
There is a musical instrument, and it looks kind of like a water well. It's about 3 feet tall, and it's got it's a circle, it's a tube. It's got about a diameter of also, you know, 2 to 3 feet. And basically, it's this touch screen on top,
okay,
like a piece of acrylic. And you've got all of these blocks that look like play blocks, and on each face is it like a different graphic?
Okay.
And it's really basic. Like, you've got a triangle, or you've got like a little image of a sound wave. But once you put the blocks onto the table reacts and a noise is produced. And based on the relationship of the blocks, whether you put it farther away or, you know, or place the blocks farther away from each other or rotate the blocks or put a different face of a certain block onto this screen, a different sound is produced or a different harmony is produced or a different beat, like slower or faster. And it's just insane. Like, it's just so much fun. When my friend and I went, we like hogged this instrument for like 30 minutes because we were like, this is so awesome.
How long is it going to be there? Do you know?
I think until September. It opened in September and it was going to be
so
here.
It's going to be a year?
Year?
Awesome. Yeah, so go. It's in Hyde Park. It's in the Museum of Science and Industry.
Yeah.
Hyde Park. And then you can check out H.H. Holmes Murder House. You know
which
what I'm talking about?
It's always a pleasure.
It's a post office now. Post office building in Hyde Park.
No.
World's Fair, Devil in the White City.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay.
The vertical farm seems like a perfect combination for someone like you of like art, but like saving the world / architecture. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you want to do that?
Because
that seems like not only are you building something cool to look at, you're having a direct impact on making life better.
The world a better place.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, seriously, why not do that?
No, I mean, of course, being involved in these things is wonderful, and it's awesome because you are, you know, really changing the way that the world lives. And in 50 years, I mean, maybe vertical farms are going to be located everywhere.
I mean, I just when you were talking about that, all I could think of was Detroit.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole downtown is essentially empty. That would be beautiful to do that. And
Detroit is a whole different,
but this
is a fascinating city.
That's one way to put it. But it just seems like that would solve so many issues there.
So many
anywhere
problems.
Yeah, not just there, anywhere.
Yeah. Detroit, I mean, actually, you know, at this point you could just farm
Yeah.
in like horizontal lots. Like, the vertical farm, I think, was designed to be a prototype for, like, super high-dense cities.
Like Tokyo or something?
Yeah, like Tokyo, like in China, these cities are, you know, where land is just literally getting eaten up and, and, you know, it's just crazy. So it would be...
I'm just saying, I'm looking at you like, why wouldn't you do this? Like, this makes sense to me. What's going on with that, actually? Do you know?
The vertical farm?
Yeah, like, is there progress on this? Is it just an idea?
Well, I think the last I heard, well, this was before the recession and, you know,
but this seems to happen. But this would be job creation, too, though. That's
the
thing. It
would be job creation, these things. I mean, you know, but it's the same every time you want to do something new, no matter how amazing it sounds. Mm-hmm. There's going to be a lot of skepticism.
Of course, of course.
Surrounding that, you know. But, the last I heard was that at the last Council of Tall Buildings and Urban Habitats, CTBUH.
Is it really called the Council of Tall Buildings?
And Urban Habitats, yes.
It sounds like the first part was written by like whoever's child who wrote the second part. Urban Habitats, not Tall Buildings, 3-year-old.
Awesome, yeah, let's do it.
It's sweet.
Every
you know
year
exactly
they...
what the council's going to talk about.
But, and... You know, Dixon was asked to give a lecture, or give a speech, or give a presentation on this vertical farm thing. And so they were thinking of doing one in Dubai because it would be totally sweet. And
they have money there to do that.
Exactly. And it's, you know, it would definitely be some kind of an icon, which is totally...
Dubai.
There, yeah. So
for those of you that don't know Dubai, you have to look it up because there's... Hold on. I don't know why I said hold on. Like, they're going to be like, okay, like just talk. Okay. We'll wrap it up soon. Don't worry. Don't worry. Right now. Not right now. Give me like 3 minutes, okay?
Oh, my God. Okay.
Because I don't like to edit. It's weird. I think this is more comfortable and odd in a weird way. You know what I mean?
Okay. Yeah.
I like keeping this in. This is not the outtake. This is part of the show. Anyways, look up Dubai. There's no way we're going to be able to explain it. Sabina, you're a great friend. I hope to see you more often. Hopefully, you can come on again so we can talk about the first time I interviewed you. Like, 6 years ago.
For school.
Yeah, for school. I interviewed... Yeah, you are one of the few people I've interviewed. This will now be the second time. So thank you.
Thank you.
Anything you want to, like, plug? I don't know.
Pleasure.
You're not in a band or anything. I mean...
No.
Don't check out your Facebook, because that's weird.
Yeah,
is it on private?
Look at my Facebook.
Is it on private?
I don't think so.
I'd make it private. Just make it private. Just do that.
I have a terrible icon up. Yeah, well...
No, your icon is wonderful. And now I'm telling people to go check it out. Don't check out her profile. That's awful. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brendan.
We're shaking head. No one's can see.
No one's seeing this, but it feels right.
I'm going to end the show with the second Sally song. I made a video for two Sally songs. The last show ended with one of those songs. This is the other song. Please just go to the website to check it out. It's youmethemeverybody.com. That's it. Thanks so much. Have a good night.
Thanks. Bye, guys.